You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about how the Peanuts comic strips helped shape American culture and the lives of some well-known writers and artists. Andrew Blauner is our guest. He's the founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency and editor of the book we're talking about, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a Peanuts fan yourself, a Charlie Brown fan? Which character can you best relate to? Do you have a favorite comic strip that you remember? Maybe you still have it clipped or up on your computer. Have you learned a life lesson from Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the rest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. I'm 80 years old, and my roommate in college is in West Virginia, and we've kept up all this time. I just sent her a Snoopy and the Gang Christmas card that's musical. She sent me a wooden music box where it's the doghouse and Snoopy's laying on the top looking at the sky. And we went to a girls' college, and lights were out at 10 o'clock. And we would take flashlights under the blankets and read all the comic strips of Snoopy in
there. Wow.
And my favorite is when Snoopy was lost in the grass. And he would jump way up high, and then he'd scream, and he'd jump again. That was always my favorite. But I like Lucy, too.
Connie, thank you so much for sharing that story. Andrew, when you kicked off this project, did you have people kind of coming out of the woodwork to tell their Charlie Brown stories?
I love that caller's story. And by the way, I do want to mention that the publisher of the book deserves a lot of credit. That's the Library of America. Mm-hmm. And also, just to answer your question, to go back to the genesis, I met Schultz 20 years ago in 1999, and I didn't realize at the time just how unusual it was to get an audience with him. It was like meeting the Wizard of Oz. And once we were able to get the project, get a publisher for it, to your question, yes, people started coming out of the woodwork, as you say, and again, apprehension, if you can call it that, was that there would be a homogeneity to it, that everybody would be writing similar stories. But wow, was that not the case at all? Because there's a piece about the music and the soundtrack. There's a piece about Sally. There's a lot about there's something about Franklin and Pigpen. I mean, it's not just all character studies. But yes, there are people like Ann Patchett in the book who says that probably she would have never become a writer had it not been for the strip. And for a lot of people, Snoopy was the first writer, and we forget somehow that he was a writer. Snoopy was unpublished, but it was a dark, stormy night. That's where he started.
Connie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Andrew, you met Charles Schultz. I hear that he was not a glory-seeking kind of guy, a person very self-effacing. Is that something that matched up with your impression of him?
Completely so. I wrote him a letter in 1999 asking him, total shot in the dark, whether he would consider actually writing something for another book I was working on behalf of somebody else. And he wrote, I expected just a form letter at best, and instead I got this personal note saying he was declining writing for this other project, but if I ever find myself in Santa Rosa, California, please stop by. And I thought, are you kidding? Like the next day I started planning a trip to happen to put me in Santa Rosa, California. And yes, absolutely, positively, his humility and humanity and sort of gentle humor, coupled with the melancholy and sort of existential angst that he had, was completely endearing and disarming and consistent with what we knew about him before.
Let's go back to our callers. Marilyn is with us in Washburn. Marilyn, hi.
Hey, hi, Rob and Andrew. What a fun book to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, you just mentioned Santa Rosa, and that's what I'm calling about. I live in Washburn, Wisconsin, but I've gotten to go twice to that wonderful museum, the Charles Schultz Museum that's out in Santa Rosa. And it unfortunately did not actually finalize to become open until after his death. But it is all things Charlie Brown and the Gang, and there are original sketches. There's his whole drawing table is there, and I just wanted to give a shout out about that's such a fun place to go for people who really love this. And an example, there had been a sketch about Christo and, like, covering Snoopy's house. Mm-hmm. as a Christo, you know, and mm-hmm. then Christo actually covers a doghouse, and it's out there in the museum.
Oh, wow.
It's like a Christo art piece. So there's just lots of fun things at that museum, and I can't wait to see, to get a hold of your book. So thanks.
Thank you, and amen to what you said. I was fortunate enough to be out there at that museum for the first time. We did an event with Jonathan Franzen, actually, and it is everything you just described and more, and well worth the trip.
Marilyn, thanks for that call. We're talking to Andrew Blauner, editor of the Peanuts Papers, writers and cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. You can join in with your Peanuts memories, your Charlie Brown fandom moments yourself at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hi there. One of the things about Charlie Brown cartoons for me was that, you know, a lot of us guys resonate with Charlie Brown. I was a Charlie Brown. And reading those cartoons, it was like reading, you know, somebody who understood my life. Mm. And just saying, this Charlie Brown ended up happily married with kids, having a good job, so it worked out.
But, Mark, it sounds like you found some comfort in somebody who's gone through, Charlie Brown, who's gone through some of the same struggles you were.
Hey, people pulled the football out from underneath me many times.
Okay. Mark, thank you. I'm glad things turned out well for you. But a lot of people identified, and you were saying this, a lot of people were fans and maybe identified, Andrew, with Charlie himself.
For sure. It was a surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise. I just thought everybody loves Snoopy. Everybody, you know, has their personal favorite. But I just had no idea how many people not just had affection for Charlie Brown, but really identified. And people you might not think so much. And it was interesting because Schultz was on record as saying, if, of all the characters, if they had actually been real and grown up, who would have been the most likely to have sort of a happy, healthy, normal life? And he actually said it was probably Linus. But I think the people, other than Snoopy, the character that people most identified with was certainly Charlie Brown.
Our colleagues, thanks for that call. Our colleagues identified it a couple more. Jana Rose Schleiss, morning show producer, says she loved Lucy. She realizes now it's because Lucy was loud and bossy and unapologetic. Schultz didn't make them seem like bad characteristics, an important thing for a young, loud, and sometimes bossy Jana Rose to see. Let's talk about the character of Lucy a little bit. Is that somebody that among your contributors grabbed their attention much?
For sure. I'm glad that came up because God help us if we left Lucy out of what she would do to us. But you know, we forget, too, that this was created – you know, written largely in the 50s and 60s. And Schultz, you know, he had a lot of – Lucy was a very strong, independent, say, woman, a little girl, 4 years old, some people would say, who happened to have, you know, a psychiatry practice for 5 cents. But, you know, one person's, you know, bossy and difficult was another person's strong, independent, inspiring character. And one of the contributors in the book, Peter Kramer, who's a brilliant writer, wrote Listening to Prozac and several other bestsellers. For a lot of people, it was his introduction to that world of psychology, psychiatry, and therapy, and what that means. And Lucy's advice, you know, which in the book, it's sort of debated, not directly, but whether or not she gave good advice. I mean, her advice to Charlie Brown was snap out of it. Which, you know, some people have said that's what he needed and that was good for him. But that was the other surprise, actually, in addition to Charlie Brown, of like how many people connected with and actually respected and admired Lucy.
Let's bring on John now, calling from La Crosse. John, hello.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, I want to echo just what you were saying, because I grew up as a young boy, as with many baby boomer generation members of the 1950s and 60s, and I didn't think it was wrong or unusual at that time for me to identify with a young girl, even though I'm very much a man, to empathize with everything that Lucy was going through, because I grew up actively listening to people and coming from theater. I'm a stage manager, so I would learn how to tell people to snap out of it and to also actively listen to people when I needed to. And so I didn't think there was anything wrong about her being assertive or aggressive. It was just a way that many people both boys and girls, men and women of the baby boom generation, saw that in order for them to become who they wanted to be, they had to snap out of it or assert themselves. Nothing wrong with that.
John, thanks for the call. Some more life lessons from Lucy there, Andrew.
For sure. And I'll just take the opportunity, since that caller mentioned being the theater and stage manager, that I also learned during this process that the production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is by far the most produced musical in American history. And the number of productions is at 40,000.
Wow.
And counting. And that over 250,000 people have in one form or another been in a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And there's a new national tour that has just started this month.
We're talking, thanks for that call, John. We're talking about what we've learned from the Peanuts comic strips with Andrew Blauner. He's founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency. He's editor of the new book, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a Peanuts memory? Do you have a favorite character you want to throw into the mix? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Andrew Blauner, editor of The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life. It includes 33 reflections by well-known writers and artists, including Sarah Boxer, Ira Glass, Leslie Stein, and Ann Patchett. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the Gang? Are your kids growing up with it? Are you passing it down from generation to generation? Do you identify with a particular character? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, I did a bit of reporting in the last couple of minutes. Our own Michelle Good, our technical director, her dramatic credits include Sally in that production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown in her high school days. Back to your calls now. Bruce is with us in Kenosha. Bruce, hi. Bruce, are you there? I think we lost Bruce. Let's try Gene with us then in Elkhorn. Gene, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Gene?
I wanted to tell you about how Peanuts became kind of a common language for six kids and our parents. We all read it. We all reread some. We actually had some books and things like that. So we had the common knowledge. And when someone is making a sandwich, if you got a knife out towards it, it was like, no, don't cut it, fold it over, otherwise all the flavor leaks out. And the piece where Lucy says, has five good reasons, I use that on my younger brother a lot.
Uh-oh.
she folded in her fingers and made a fist. And, another one we loved was when Linus and Lucy stood there and said, we're brother and sister and we love each other. And Charlie Brown said, you're not going to fool Santa Claus. And they go, why not? We're a couple of smart kids, and he's an old man. And, obviously, all those quotes, the quotes have stuck with me forever. And when I went through my mom's stuff after she passed away, I found dozens of clipped out Charlie Brown and Peanuts cartoons. She just valued it. It was like a philosophy for our family.
Fantastic.
It was something we shared with each other and still do, for that matter. I bet I could talk to my younger brother right now and say, hey, I've got five good reasons. He'd know exactly what I meant.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call. I think a lot of people have that sort of family connection, bonding over the Peanuts, Andrew.
I agree. She put it so well, the philosophy for family and the common language. That's exactly sort of the message in a way, that's something that, again, whether it was also like the Beatles or the Bible, some of the subjects of the other books that are put together, that in an increasingly, polarized world, that, it's to be cherished that there are things that we can have in common. And this is at the top of the list. So that's really touching to hear that from your caller.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me, one of your contributors, novelist Rick Moody, wrote about, speaking of the family connection, how his daughter took a quick liking to a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. He wrote that the special took on a lot of familiar Peanuts themes but had some poignant moments. For example, after Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving feast goes down badly, Marcy cheers him up. Here's a listen.
I don't feel bad for myself. I just feel bad because I ruined everyone's Thanksgiving.
But Thanksgiving is more than eating, Chuck. You heard what Linus was saying out there. Those early pilgrims were thankful for what had happened to them. And we should be thankful, too. We should just be thankful for being together.
So I brought up some of the darkness in Charlie Brown earlier, Andrew, but that's an example of what you brought up, too, that there's redemption and connection in it, too.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, that's just so sweet, isn't it? and Rick's piece, you know, a lot of people, you know, obviously the Halloween special and the Christmas special get sort of most of the attention and affection. But the Thanksgiving, you know, which is in between. And Rick writes about something that I think a lot of people experience, which is maybe they had their Peanuts life when they were kids and then it goes away for a while. And then when you have kids of your own, you re-experience it through their eyes. And I think Rick mentioned his daughter is basically addicted to the Thanksgiving special to the point that I think he's seen it 149 times.
We, again, asked around WPR. Morgan Stewart, our administrative coordinator, says, I'd love to hear from listeners and the guests about the characters of Franklin and Pigpen. How are they perceived by people when they first saw them? Morgan says, are any listeners aware that Franklin was the first black Peanuts character? And do they think, as I did when I was a child, that Pigpen was dirty because he was poorer than the rest of the gang? Any thoughts on Franklin and Pigpen, Andrew?
Well, that's an important point. Franklin, the same way that Schultz was sort of ahead of his time a little bit in making Lucy, for example, a strong, independent female character, he absolutely was the first to have an African-American or black character in a comic strip. And it was as a result of a letter that he got from a school teacher in California in 1968 or 69 suggesting that he do it. Schultz was sort of notorious for if you suggested something to him, it was a surefire thing he wouldn't do it because everything sort of had to come from his own mind. But he made an exception for this. And I think a lot of people benefited for that from that. And one of the contributors in the book is Jennifer Finney Boylan. And she writes about sort of a group or a class of the characters. I think she sort of puts under the umbrella of outsiders. And in there is Peppermint Patty, who's arguably a lesbian, Franklin, Marcy, Pigpen. So, again, the fallacy is that it's all about Charlie Brown and Lucy and Linus and Snoopy. But, you know, he had a good bench there.
Let's go back to our callers now. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. Let's not forget Woodstock. When I was growing up, I had a Snoopy bedspread, a Snoopy, a Peanuts wastebasket, Snoopy and Peanuts sheets. I get cards every holiday are Snoopy cards. And I took a picture and sent them to you, but it would be Snoopy dancing, and he would have his neck up, and he would be smiling, and it said, "Keep smiling. It makes people wonder what you've been up to."
Deborah, a big Snoopy. I also had the bed sheets and a pillowcase, I think, and I remember drawing pictures on a big piece of paper of the house that lived underneath Snoopy's doghouse, because at some points he describes this huge, basically underground mansion, things like that. Thanks, Deborah. Some people, as you thought, some people really do have that Snoopy connection, Andrew.
Well, yeah, and Snoopy also in that doghouse had a Van Gogh and I think an Andrew Wyeth painting, and actually Schultz clearly had an issue with that because people would – Schultz, you know, I don't know if it's a Midwestern thing or it was his melancholy or insecurity despite all the fame and success, because there was a certain point where if people were heaping too much praise on him, he'd say, yes, but I'm no Andrew Wyeth. but the Woodstock thing is funny too. When I got to meet Schultz, for some reason, one of the questions I asked him was whether Woodstock was male or female, which to this day, anytime I've mentioned that to someone, they think it's a ludicrous question because he was so obviously male. But I don't know. I'm still not totally convinced.
Did Charles Schultz have an answer?
He didn't. He sort of hedged. I asked him that, and I asked him what was Franklin's last name, and he didn't know. And I said, well, if you don't know, then nobody knows. And then afterwards it became Armstrong, actually, because we knew Brown and Van Pelt and some of the other characters' last names.
Back to our callers now. We've got Marcus with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, so I have pictures up in my kids' room now that hung in my brothers in my bedroom when we were growing up, that hung in my dad's bedroom when he was growing up. And they're on fabric, and it's you know, different colors, and there's just a single character with a little, you know, like speech bubble above it. And so you have Linus saying, "No problem is so big or so complicated that it can't be run away from." And then you have one with Snoopy, you know, with his fist in the air on top of the doghouse that says, "Curse you, Red Baron." And one with Charlie Brown sitting on the curb and says, "I developed a new philosophy. I only dread one day at a time." But, you know, that whole familial connection. And one of the other things about the specials, I really like the one where Snoopy is up flying against the Red Baron, and then the Red Baron forces him down, and then they sing Christmas carols.
Marcus, thank you so much. So great memories there. And he's decorating now his kids' room, Andrew.
Exactly. And again, my kid, who's five and to whom the book is dedicated, Sam, he has a Snoopy pillowcase, which he'll be putting his head on, hopefully, in the next hour or two.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. Just a couple minutes left. Andrew, there was no question after Charles Schulz passed away that anybody else was going to do this strip, right? Some cartoonists, there's a succession plan. It was done with him.
Exactly, for sure. And not only that, but Schulz made it clear during his life that he really wasn't interested in getting involved in politics or using his fame or platform for other purposes. And he basically was saying, anything I have to say, I say through the strip and through my characters. And sure enough, that once he was in ill health, he had to announce that he was going to stop drawing the strip. And yes, he made it very clear nobody was going to continue it. But he, some of your listeners may know, he died within 24 hours of when the last strip was published, as if something almost karmically was at play there. So that's just sort of another sort of mystical, meaningful part of Peanuts lore.
And just briefly, Andrew, do you have a favorite character that you connect with?
You know, sometimes you get that kind of question with other projects, and, oh, I love them the same, and they're all like my children. But no, it's Snoopy forever for
Snoopy
me.
Snoopy all the way. Andrew, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Blonner is the founder of Blonner Books Literary Agency and editor of several anthologies. We talked with him about his latest book. It's called The Peanuts, Papers, Writers, and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Still time to share your favorite Charlie Brown and Snoopy memories, or the other characters. Let us know your favorite. You can do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a preview of the Packers playoff game this weekend. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, payday or short-term loans can offer consumers a lifeline while creating a whole new pile of debt to worry about. Sometimes referred to as predatory lending, in Wisconsin, these types of loans can include annual interest rates of more than 400%. A new bill in the state legislature would limit that maximum annual interest rate quite a bit to match a rate enacted by Congress that applies to members of the military and their families. Senator Andre Jacques is a Wisconsin state senator representing the 1st District, which includes parts of Brown, Calumet, Door, and Kewaunee counties. He's an author of the new bill. Senator Jacques, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Great to be back.
Well, lay out for us your primary goals, please, for this legislation.
Well, and you gave a pretty good summary. So basically, we actually have a report for payday lending in Wisconsin for the most recent year that we had that report, although the 2019 report should be coming out shortly. It was an average rate of 486%. Now, many years that climbs above 500% in terms of the average rate for payday lending. And, of course, you have auto title loans as well that are similarly in that same stratosphere. But we really call it toxic credit. It's this endless cycle of debt that thousands upon thousands of Wisconsin residents are trapped in. And we have the numbers, again, from the industry that bear that out. These are really loans that are put together, in many cases, seemingly designed to not be able to be paid back. And that causes a whole host of societal issues. It causes desperation. It certainly causes a great amount of stress and difficulty for the individuals who are taking on this debt. And so, as you had mentioned, we already have legislation that's been enacted at the federal level, which Congressman Grothman, Representative Chuy Garcia, I believe, also has introduced legislation together to similarly extend that rate cap for other loans. But that's really what we're seeking to do in Wisconsin, is saying, you know, we're not just going to protect our active duty service members, but veterans and all citizens. And so really we're taking a hit out against predatory lending.
The argument for payday lending in some cases is, okay, yes, if it's annualized, it's a big rate, but the idea is it's a payday loan. You take the loan now, you pay us off in 7 days or 2 weeks or whatever when you get that paycheck. Do we not seeing it play out that way?
No, I mean, I think when you look at the average loans that are given out and the fact that you know, you're looking at over a quarter of the time there's a supplemental loan that then is taken out, and you're really only seeing about half these initial loans ever really getting paid back by the statistics. We're really not seeing it limited to, like you would say, a very short-term loan with what would then seemingly be a more reasonable rate of interest. And certainly this can be a discussion starter. We might end up at a different place, but the reality is we have very little regulation of payday lending, and in Wisconsin we have less than pretty much any other state. So it is something that I think it's important that you know, we take a look at this. Very proud that we have very strong bipartisan support in both chambers for this proposal.
What specific businesses would this apply to? Because there are things that are called payday lending. There's title loans. There's a lot of variety when it comes to these short-term lenders.
Sure. So basically, if you are a lender other than a financial institution that is making consumer loans exceeding $5,000 in principal, you would have to obtain a license to be a licensed lender and then would be subject to that 36% interest rate cap. So certainly it would catch anything that where you're talking about loaning large amounts where that rate of interest is going to catch up very quickly. You know, certainly people can come up with theoretical loans that might seem more innocuous or reasonable. The reality is that's not really what we're talking about, and we're certainly focused on catching the bad actors that, again, have caused financial ruin for so many individuals and families throughout our state.
One argument is that this could put some of these lenders out of business, and they wouldn't exist if there wasn't some kind of need for it. A group of Wisconsinites who aren't served by better-known financial institutions, is there something in out there that can take the place of these payday lenders and other short-term lenders?
Well, certainly they've found a way to make it profitable for themselves in terms of the debt that people are on the hook for that then can be enforced and collected. But just because they've found a way to make it profitable doesn't mean that there necessarily is a need that can't be filled through other means. And I guess I would push back on that a bit in terms of it indicating that there is a need other than, you know, I think that it's selling promises with misleading advertising that this is somehow, you know, again, auto loans themselves in many cases are not, you know, the securing the loan with the vehicle is in many cases not even really the goal. They're just trying to get people to sign on to that high rate of interest. And any vehicle assets that would be retained by the lender if they go into default are almost minuscule. They would go to auction essentially.
Now, you mentioned Congressman Glenn Grothman. I remember bringing him on our shows here years ago when he was in the state legislature. He was fighting an uphill battle to try to get regulations on payday lenders, not getting a lot of support from his and your party at the time. Do you think that the time that this is a time where you can make something like this happen?
You know, I think there will be that time. I don't know if this is necessarily that time. I'm certain that it's going to face an uphill challenge with some members of leadership. But the reality is, this is a statement of where I'm at and where I've been at for some time. I appreciate Congressman Grothman's leadership on this, and I've been on the losing side of some lonely votes in the legislature in terms of whether it's been rent-to-own or payday loans, some efforts to kind of roll back some of the consumer protections that I think we have a reason to expect in our state.
Senator Jacques, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
Andre Jacques is a Wisconsin state senator representing the 1st District, which spans Brown, Calumet, Door, and Kewaunee counties. Now we bring on Hader Kerbin. He joins us for more on the impact of payday lending. He's professor of economics and director of the Center on Race and Wealth at Howard University. Hader, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Well, we heard a specific effort here in Wisconsin. Can you broaden this out for us? How big a problem do you see payday lending being across the U.S.?
Well, payday lending is a huge. At one time, they had more, you know, payday lending storefronts than McDonald's stores. So this is they were so big. But there are two phases of it. One phase that in late 90s, some state governments, and most of them, they started to change the usury laws, and that kind of allowed the payday lending to expand in many states. As this, the consumers were negatively affected by this problem, some states, they started to, you know, push back on it. And the pushback is kind of changing the regulations, either prohibiting, you know, the payday lending, you know, functions, they're functioning in the states, or putting some limits on the terms and interest rates that they charge. So currently, so in these two waves, currently there are 10 states that prohibit, you know, payday lending in their states, plus DC, District of Columbia. And there are some other states that they are, you know, implementing different regulations and restrictions on it. These are, can be, you know, the rate cap. You know, some states, they put the maximum, you know, interest rate, annual interest rate that they can charge at the 36% or 30%. And some states, they use other kind of restrictions on rollover. You know, they don't allow them to do more rollovering, or in other words, to selling the same person, you know, multiple loans, or on the terms, they do some restrictions. Interestingly, you know, Wisconsin is right now is one of those states that really doesn't have much limits on any activities of the payday lending.
Talk about a typical case where someone might get caught in that situation. People have called it a, you know, a downward spiral of debt in the past. Talk about how that can stack up.
Well, it's basically for these are small loans, right? You apply and you get, like, let's say, you know, $500, and you pay like $10 or $15 or $20 on each $100. And depending on the state's regulations, that can be, you know, 300%, 520% per annually. And this is the population that in our studies shows that these are the population that is not using payday loans just for one time or second time. On average, at payday lender, I mean, the borrower gets like around 8 to 10 loans. So these are, this is a huge burden. So it's not really just people are using for one time, and it's just to do something that is very, you know, important.
You've done work, I think, on recipients of Social Security and similar benefits relying on these kinds of loans. So what do we know about that?
The Social Security recipients, this is a different group, and they are kind of a better target for the industry because they have a steady check every month. They either get a retirement check or they get some checks for some other benefits. And because of that, they become a good, you know, customer base for the industry. And our studies show that, you know, most of the use of the payday loans among the Social Security recipients is not much different than the general population. Usually the lower income population uses the payday loans more. And what we also show that is, interestingly, people use more payday loans. The Social Security recipients use more payday loans when the pay period is longer. So which means that this population that use payday loans is cash strapped. They need, you know, money, right? And they cannot make the end of the month. So whenever this pay period extends against it longer, they get more payday loans or other type of you know, loans.
We're talking with economics professor Hader Kerbin of Howard University about payday lending and a new bill in Wisconsin that would add some regulations to those lenders. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used payday lending or other short-term loans? What was the experience like for you? Was it just a quick short-term loan, or did you get caught up in debt over the long term? Should Wisconsin do more to regulate this industry? As we've heard from both our guests, Wisconsin is on the lighter side when it comes to regulation of payday lending. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about payday lending and some possible new regulations here in Wisconsin. Hader Kerbin is with us, economics professor and director of the Center on Race and Wealth at Howard University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin should regulate these short-term lenders, or are things fine as they are? Have you used short-term lending? Have you worked in this business? Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Julia is with us now in Winona, Minnesota. Julia, hi.
Hi. Would you want- I use payday loans for about 5 years, 6 years. and you get hooked into them and you can't get out of them. You just, there's no stopping. And luckily I had a financial advisor who said, you have to stop and stay away. And I made a commitment to myself never to have another one, and I haven't.
Julia, thanks for the call, and congratulations on getting out of that cycle. A common story, do you think, Hadar?
Yes, it's a very common story. Actually, now we have enough data sources that, you know, they ask people, why do you use it, right? I mean, the biggest thing is coming is that, you know, people find it very convenient. So they are more convenient than banks or other institutions. So they make themselves available, and as a result, you know, people use them. And usually when another question is when you ask people, why do you use it? And usually when people start to use it, they think that they're going to just get it once or twice, but it doesn't end up that way. And this is kind of another result that we get from consumer surveys.
Julia, thanks again for sharing your story. We'll go now to Bradley in Tupelo, Mississippi. Bradley, hi.
Hi, I'm right here.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Bradley?
I was thinking about the alternatives that folks face when they're, you know, looking at a bill and they need cash. So what, you know, what's the alternative?
Bradley, thanks a lot for the call. That's a question people raise a fair amount, Hadar. There are not always legal alternatives, other legal options for people who need that short-term money.
Yes, usually this is the when people have needs for small, you know, loans. That's the case, right? For example, my research shows that the Social Security beneficiaries, right, they just need that extra $100 until their next paycheck comes in, right? And the banks or the other institutions, they are not, you know, providing small loans. And also people have this fear of, you know, bounce checks and other things. And those fees are tend to be even sometimes higher than the interest, the rate, the fees that the payday lenders are charging. So there is some push on that, you know, the CFPB is kind of pushing this. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is pushing that, you know, banks should provide people some small loans. But there haven't been much done in that area. It's just basically people don't have enough cash, you know, and until they get the next paycheck.
Bradley, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We've talked to a researcher here in Wisconsin, J. Michael Collins, who's looked a lot at kind of a lack of financial services in general for low-income people, not just those small loans, but useful savings vehicles, checking vehicles, credit, that kind of thing. Is this part of a wider problem of kind of financial service deserts, in effect, for low-income people?
That's true. And usually people use, you know, people who are using payday loans, they also use other, what people call alternative financial services, you know, pawn shops, car loans, other things. So these are, so this is basically, you have a part of population that is financially in trouble, have a hardship, and is looking kind of loans to get by. And they either pay their loans or something else, you know, they are just doing them.
Talking about payday lending and other short-term lending, Hadar Kerbin is with us from Howard University. We heard that Wisconsin has new legislation maybe in the works that would lower interest, would cap interest rates on payday lenders and other short-term lenders. Back to your calls now. Richard is with us in Eau Claire. Richard, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And when I lived in Michigan, Roger City, Michigan, the credit union actually advertised, before taking a payday loan, come and see them. I'm just wondering if anybody else has experience with credit unions really being that replacement for the payday loan.
Richard, thanks for the call. Have you seen, Hadar, this being a thing around the country, credit unions or other institutions really trying to offer something competitive with these payday lenders?
Well, there is some support for that, and some credit unions, they are doing it, but they are, I think they are, in terms of the scale, they are not as big as the, you know, the demand is. But you know, there are some of them are doing it. I work with a project that some church groups, they started, their credit unions were doing it in Alabama. But these are, you know, these are very small efforts in terms of the impact.
Thanks a lot for the call. Richard, we heard on our Ideas Network Facebook page from Joel. Joel says, whatever happened to the principle of caveat emptor, choices and actions have consequences. And Pete wrote, as long as they're upfront about it, that if people are dumb enough to use them, then they get what they deserve. What do you think, Hadar, if they post their interest rates and let you know what you're getting into? It's up to the consumer to take care of themselves.
Well, there is one group was advocating that, you know, the reason people are taking these loans because they are not financial literate. In other words, they don't understand what are the terms and other things. And in the research, the support for this is not much. This is a bigger problem. There's a big segment of the society, they cannot bring the end, and they are living paycheck to paycheck. And they are, and this is their financial needs. When they are not met, they just go to payday loan lenders and others. The payday lendings, they are using the convenience store kind of model. They are convenient, they are available, they are close by, and as a result, they're accessible. So this is the success of the industry. And as a result, they are costly. They are charging higher rates is not because they are predatory or they're making a lot of profit, which they do, but it's also these are small shops and they have a high fixed cost, and they can only function when the interest rate of fees are high. In fact, when Oregon, this is the most recent one, when they put a cap on the interest rate, annual interest rate of 36%, most of the payday lenders disappeared from Oregon because they couldn't function. It was not profitable.
Let's go back to our callers. Mary is with us in Butternut. Mary, hi.
Hi. I got an $800 loan from CashNet USA, and they're charging me 333% interest. And it's $222.24 for 10 months. It becomes a very expensive $800 car.
Mary, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. So Mary has encountered this firsthand, Hadar. And is it always obvious to the customer that this is the kind of rate? Is that information explicit and clear to people when they walk in the door?
No, these are fees, right? They just give you the fee, and people think that they're gonna pay this fee. This is like sometimes people think this is like a bounce back check, right? Let's say you have a check that's gonna be bounced. To avoid that, you pay this fee, you get a payday loan, and that fee is could be lower than what the bank is charging you. But the story doesn't end there, right? Usually, this is a very small percentage of the customers. Most of the people who are getting payday loans, they just, need a loan to just, to survive that month. And then they're going to have the same need again and again. And as a result, they get multiple loans.
In our last few moments, Hadar, we have this effort anyway. We'll see where it goes here in Wisconsin. Has there been a trend of states trying to regulate these payday lenders more and more?
Yes. As I said initially, at the beginning of my talk, that is, initially, a lot of states, they allow them, they even help them to expand. But then as the consumers push back, some states, they prohibited that. Right now, as it stands, 10 states plus the District of Columbia, they don't allow them to function in their states. So in these states, there is no payday lending store. And there are also about like 5 or 6 states they put some limits on the interest rate that they can charge. Because the limits are not profitable, these are Connecticut, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon, and hopefully Wisconsin is going to be another one. In that case, the industry cannot function because these rates are not profitable for them. But that is not a solution in terms of the small credit problem, because people might go to the other kind of loans, right? So the problem is bigger. It really is an income problem. There's a big segment of population that is in the need of credit.
We'll keep watching this issue. Thanks to Hadar Kerbin for joining us from Howard University. We also heard from Wisconsin State Senator Andre Jacques, author of a bill that would regulate payday lending. Up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll catch up with the latest news on impeachment, congressional reaction to the U.S. airstrike in Iraq, and more in our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics, plus a look at the latest numbers on refugee admissions here in the state. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests look at heart health and whether popular nutritional supplements really make a difference for our long-term well-being. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. then exercise can help more than just our physical health. The author of The Joy of Movement tells us that getting active can build happiness and hope, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your gift.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks to members like you, WPR is a place where every day we can learn something new, get news we trust, expand our perspective, and enjoy great entertainment just when we need it. Your support makes everything you enjoy on WPR possible. Thank you.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump and his top advisors are being pressured to disclose more details about the intelligence that led to the U.S. drone strike.